Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 7th of December 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board and thanks very much for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. As we're always say on these shows, there's always plenty to cover. And frankly, tonight I've got too much material. I know I've got too much material, so we're going to rush through a few things and I probably won't cover it all. But as with all of these shows that it's just my show rather than actually having a guest on, I've probably done too much work beforehand to try and make it all work. And there's lots of material. So I'm going to pretty much get started straight away. As with all of these shows, we just start with the normal introduction because I just want people to understand what we're going to do today. So this is the running order. And as with all of these things, things like house rules, we'll cover those, about the models, key slides, but the bulk of the show will be questions and answers. And I'm happy to go wherever you want me to go on the Q&A. I do have my other models and things here as well. The sign off, about 9:30 plus or minus. May go on a bit longer than that because I've got so much to talk about, but we'll see. And just in terms of the house rules, as I remind you, this isn't financial advice. This is just a general conversation. If you need a financial advisor to give you a financial advice, go find one. I'm not that person. Do play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, as at the 7th of December, of course, tonight, if you're watching this in replay. And if you want to get my attention, use at Walk the World. That'll make sure that your question gets to the top of the list. I'd also say to you that in the early part of the show, while I'm going through some of my material, I won't necessarily be looking at the chat that often. So you might want to hold off on your big questions until I move into the Q&A section. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can make sure your question gets to the top of the queue. Or indeed, if you'd like to make a donation to help fund what we do here, would be appreciated. We don't do it to make money. We do it because we think it's important that we share some of the ideas and thoughts we have here. Now, just quickly on the core model, as you may know, those who are new here may not know, but most will, I survey households. We have 52,000 households in the model, and a lot of the work tonight will be based around the findings from that core market model, which runs up till the end of November. It's on a weekly basis, and it's pretty detailed. We look at a lot of information coming in from all sources, including our surveys. And we can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, looking at across the geographies, property status, household segment status, all of that stuff. And we can also then put it through our core market model, and that core market model then drives some of our scenarios. We'll touch on that a bit later. In other words, how might the economy play out later? What does it mean in terms of interest rates and mortgage stress, those sorts of things? And so it goes on, really. And I will just make the point that the core market model powers our own price scenario. So we take the mortgage stress data, the price trajectory and history data, the buying and selling intentions, and the migration statistics, other economic data. We bang it all through the core market model. And that, of course, includes all the scenarios. And we can then create some information down at a postcode level. And again, I'll be showing some information at a postcode level tonight. And if we have time, we can look at that in a little bit more detail. I also just will mention again the DFA one-to-one service. We do have the ability to have a one-to-one conversation with people about a particular suburb. And sometimes it's quite useful to have a confidential conversation about a suburb. I can't give financial advice specifically, but I can tell you about the specific trends at a postcode level, which can be quite helpful sometimes. Look at the underlying trends and also where things may be going. I can look at the stress, the home price data, and the other information from our surveys. And based on our modelling, we can create a view as to what might be going to happen. You can book a time, Zoom or phone, whichever, about an hour or so. There is a cost involved, and we are running about 3 to 5 weeks ahead in terms of booking, simply because we've got quite a few people who want to chat about things at the moment. Things are quite uncertain. People are looking for different points of view. And so we find these one-to-one service are quite useful things to get involved in. And then I want to just show you this slide. This was from investing.com. Great cartoon here with Chairman Powell being beaten up by Omicron, inflation and tapering, and the bears all getting around him. I think that's a very good summation as to what precisely is going on at the moment, because frankly, there's a lot going on. And as I've said in the last few posts, you know, I don't think I've ever seen so much uncertainty. And there are people taking such different positions about what's going on. So tonight what I want to do is try and cover off some of that uncertainty and talk about some of the things that we are seeing and try and figure out, you know, where it might go next, really. Now, the RBA, of course, released their minutes today of their meeting. Not the full minutes, it's just a quick note. Basically, they're going to continue to do QE, government securities, at the rate of $4 billion until mid-February. They basically said no change to the cash rate. They're saying that the economy is bouncing back after Delta. Inflation's increased, but in underlying terms is still low at 2.1%. Well, that's just, of course, a Mickey Mouse number. We know the real number's a lot higher than that. And that while they say the headline inflation is 3%, the fact is they're only going to see a gradual expectation. Underlying inflation is, I think, higher than the RBA's official numbers, not least because, of course, property prices is not probably included in them. And then they say that house prices have increased significantly, household credit's grown, and it's important that lending standards are maintained. Well, yeah, they would say that, but they're not doing much to try and support that, so we'll see. And then they also went on to say that globally the bond yields have declined a bit, and interestingly, in February they're going to consider what to do around their bond purchase programs. Nothing until then, really. They'll have about $350 billion of bonds issued by the Australian government. And that's a big stimulus. That's a big stimulus into the system. So stimulus is continuing. And interestingly, I thought this was fascinating. They've now said what we do beyond that will be guided by three things: the actions of other central banks, how the Australian bond market is functioning, and most importantly, the actions of making progress towards the goals of full employment and inflation consistent with the target. So they've basically, you know, walked away from some of the things that they've said previously. But I think the actions of other central banks is the key thing there, because what it basically means is if we find that the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and, you know, even the Bank of New Zealand's already done it, if they keep lifting rates, RBA will have to. So there's a bit of an opening there to suggest that perhaps the RBA will move those rates sooner than they were saying. They were still saying 2024 earlier on, of course. And then they also made the last point there that the board's committed to maintaining highly supportive monetary conditions. Yeah, we've seen that before. Full employment, inflation pressures are less than many other countries. Again, the real numbers are higher than the official numbers. And in terms of wages growth, they're still looking for that, but they think it's going to take some time and therefore they're going to be patient. So, you know, at the end of the day, not much here that really changed anything. But it's interesting that I think they are probably allowing a little bit more growth than previously, but nothing else much in their numbers. It's interesting to see how it's interpreted, and we'll get the minutes, of course, in a couple of weeks' time. Now, this was actually quite an interesting piece of information. And this was a survey from the CBA, and the headline was "Buying Intentions Slump in November." And the article from the AIFR says fewer home buyers are making plans to enter the market amid an extended surge in listings. A record number of auctions is forecast this weekend. Home buying intentions plummeted by 27.5% in November and by 17.7% over the year amid worries of high interest rates, tighter credit, and worsening affordability, according to a CBA survey of spending plans. Now, the decline in the CBA's home buying intention index coincides with a drop in home loan applications at the banks and lower Google searches relating to home buying. Yep, we're seeing that in our surveys too. People are getting quite twitchy about property. We're seeing listings rise. We're seeing interest beginning to wane. And, of course, it's getting harder to get a loan. So all of that's going to play out, I think, in the months ahead. Go on to the next part of the conversation there. And this is the consumer index. This is from Roy Morgan ANZ. And they basically said consumer confidence was up a bit, 1.4%. And even the weekly inflation expectations rose a touch to 4.9%. So people are still thinking inflation's there. There was a bit of variety amongst the cities. But essentially, if you look at where the indication is currently, it's still, you know, a bit below the long-term average. And I'm seeing that in my surveys too, not a lot of real momentum that I'm seeing at the moment. Now, the other thing that happened today was the ABS released their quarterly price information relating to house prices. And so I thought I'd just quickly give you the headline information on this because it's quite interesting. Remember that this is driven very much by CoreLogic with a little bit of tweaking by the ABS, but it's basically CoreLogic data dressed up as something government issued, which I have concerns about, but there you go, it is what it is. And interestingly, they basically said that residential property prices over the last quarter were up 5% in the third quarter and up 21.7% over the last 12 months. And the total value of residential dwellings in Australia is now $9.25 trillion. And they rose $487 billion in the quarter. And the mean price up $42,000 to $863,700. Now, of course, that's an average, doesn't tell you anything at all, but basically it shows that things are rising. Now, if you look at it by city, you can see that there's a bit of a change. Hobart 8.2% over the quarter, Sydney 6.2%, Brisbane 6.1%, Canberra 6%, the average 5%, Darwin 1.6%, Perth 2%, Melbourne 3.6%. So a significant variety by the city. And you can look at the chart there by trend over a long time, and you can see that there's been a significant run-up. Not surprising, of course. Low interest rates, very loose lending, very accommodative, and, of course, all the government stimulus, all driving prices the same way. But I'd remind you that there's a similar chart from the Bank of New Zealand, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, showing a big rise and then a projected fall. And I think probably we are going to be looking for a fall ahead. It's just a question of how much of a fall. Now, just quickly, if you go through each of the states and cities, you can see there that Sydney was up 6.2%. You can also see that houses were moving much faster than attached dwellings, which, of course, includes units, high-rise and low-rise. Of course, they don't really split out low-rise and high-rise. They should. High-rise hasn't done much. In fact, they've dropped in areas. Some of the low-rise has been more significant. Melbourne, only 3.6%. Again, a similar trend with a significant rise in house prices, less with low rise. Brisbane up 6.1%, massive rise up in Brisbane. I think there's more there. There's a 50,000 or so migrants wanting to come up to Queensland once the borders are open. A lot of demand for Brisbane property. Adelaide up 5.9%. Mostly, as you can see there, it's mostly to do with houses rather than attached dwellings. Perth, only 2%. There was a bit of a spike earlier on in the year. It's dropping away again. I'm seeing that in my surveys too. A lot of people were shocked that things have not continued. All the agents, of course, were talking about massive booms in Perth. Hasn't really happened. And in fact, if you look carefully in the Perth markets, there are some areas which have done quite well, particularly on houses, but a lot of units less so. So again, the granularity is really important here. If we then look at Hobart, massive rise, 8.2%, been very strong, and interestingly up 25.7% over the last 12 months. And Darwin, just 1.6% in the quarter, up 13.7% over the last 12 months. But you can see there that, look at Darwin from 2016, basically years and years and years, months and months and months of falls, and then a couple of small peaks. And yet, of course, all the agents are saying it's all really, really boomy. Well, I'm not sure it is. Canberra, big boom recently coming off, and interestingly again, it's mostly houses rather than units. 25.2% over the last 12 months. That's the largest annual rise since the commencement of the series in Canberra. And overall, over $9.2 trillion in value. Pretty amazing, really. And if just think about this, back in 2017, that was when they put the brakes on investment lending, right? At that stage, total dwelling stock was worth about $6.8 trillion. It's now over $9 trillion, so it's gone up more than $3 trillion, and that's all to do with owner occupied, thanks to low rates, government stimulus, and easy lending from the banks. It's disgraceful. Talk about a bubble, it's a big bubble. Now, HILDA also came out today. This is the household income data survey. Now, the data is only till 2019, so don't get too excited, because, of course, that's pre-COVID. But nevertheless, they do highlight the fact that there is a proportion of people who are experiencing indicators of financial stress, things like can't pay an electricity bill, pawned, went without meals, etc., etc. And the numbers, they say, have come down a bit, but, of course, that's pre-COVID, I suspect, will go up again. Not sure how helpful that is, but then they say, well, look at it like this, with two more indicators, and by different types of people. So there are some segments like single parents, 28% have financial stress in a given year, compared with elderly male at 16%, elderly female at 16.9%, and all persons at 11.9%. Point I want to make to you, their definition of stress is a very narrow one, and it's specifically relating to certain issues, as I showed you. Doesn't work the same way as my definition of stress, so got to be a bit careful. We'll see a lot of coverage of HILDA, and of course the Reserve Bank uses the HILDA data for a lot of its justification, but it's based on 2019 data, so it's way out of date, so I'm not sure how really relevant it is now. And it's also interesting here, they showed that people who were in stress were considerably more likely to move house, or indeed maybe even cease being a house owner compared with those who are not, which I thought was quite interesting. And we're certainly seeing that on our survey. So one of the motivations we're seeing at the moment is people wanting to get out because they know that they can't manage that mortgage. So it is a consistent driver of activity in the market. And we are seeing a number of mortgagee in possession sales at the moment. Now, before I get on to my mortgage stress, CanStar released their surveys, only 2,124 surveys, but I suppose it's better than nothing. And basically they said mortgage stress is going to rise. 47% of survey respondents anticipate slower price rises. Only 12% see those measures improving. And 23% of Australians expecting to see an increase in foreclosures and mortgage stress, et cetera, et cetera. So it does look as though some people are beginning to wake up to the fact that things are not quite as buoyant as perhaps everyone in politics would want you to believe. And Steve Mickenbecker from CanStar and I discussed last Thursday a dose of financial wisdom. I think it came out on Friday, actually, thinking about it. And that's worth watching because he made some really interesting points there about what's really going on. So I recommend that if you've not seen that show, it's worth going and having a look. Now, my mortgage stress, it's a tad lower in November. Now, just to define a tad, it's a smaller insignificant amount according to the dictionary definition. So we've got mortgage stress at 41.2%. Now, remember that I define mortgage stress in cash flow terms, money in, money out. So it's not the same way as HILDA does it, or indeed the way that CanStar does it. It's looking very much at cash flow, not a set percentage like 30% of income going on the mortgage. So it's still very high, and comparing it with pre-COVID, where it was at 32%, we're still at 41%. So there's a considerable rise and move there. And if you compare that with the household debt ratio, which is going up again, you can see that we have a bit of an issue. Now, if I just move that on quickly and just show you that the yellow areas are areas where the stress levels have risen in the last month. The bluey ones are where it's dropped. And so you can see there that mortgage stress has risen in the ACT, New South Wales, and the Northern Territories. It's fallen in the other states to give us a 41.23%, which translates to 1.5 million households in mortgage stress across the country. Overall, number of households are more than 9.5 million. Rental stress has been rising in the Northern Territories, Tasmania, Victoria, and Western Australia. 40.95%, that's higher than last month. And investor stress, a little bit higher in Queensland, South Australia, a little lower in some of the other states. And that's because we've had quite a little shift now in terms of people renting. Some people have moved to cheaper renting, and some people also, of course, have now got more hours than they had previously. And the overall financial stress metric has risen in a number of states: ACT, New South Wales, Northern Territories, Queensland, and Victoria, but it was lower in South Australia, Tasmania, and Western Australia. And the overall number was a little higher. Now, that is a quick summary of what's been going on. So we're seeing a patchwork quilt again, as you perhaps would expect at the moment, between all these different metrics going on at the moment. And we can look at it by segment as well. And again, I've just highlighted the most significant numbers. These aren't necessarily up or down from last month, but the big numbers are young growing families in mortgage stress, including a lot of first-time buyers, a lot of people on the edge of town at 72 and 63%. You know, they're in the urban ring. They're often people who've bought into the high growth areas. Then if you look at rental stress, we've got more mature, stable families and a lot of multicultural people, so first-generation Australians who are renting have got issues, as well as young affluents and young growing families. And then investor stress is pretty high as well, particularly, and this is very interesting, top end of town, exclusive professionals, got multiple investment properties, some of them aren't performing, and young affluents, 50.69% of affluents have issues. And if you look at financial stress overall, again, across the different segments, quite a few segments are actually experiencing issues, but some of the more affluent households, again, are actually feeling it. So one of the things I always say to people is don't just assume that mortgage stress is something that you know, lower socioeconomic groups or the urban fringe are being impacted by. Stress is actually hitting different segments of the population. And overall, these are quite concerning numbers, I think. Now, if I then quickly go on to the next part of the story, which is just quickly on the postcodes. So this is mortgage stress. The top postcode this time around was Campbelltown, places like that. 2560 with more than 10,000 in mortgage stress. These are the numbers, the count of households. And it's also highlighting that Liverpool is number two at more than 10,000. And then we go up to Queensland, Toowoomba, and they're around there, all more than 10,000 households. Then we go to WA. And then we go to a number of Victorian postcodes, including Narrowarren, Berwick and Harkaway, and Sydenham, all high growth corridors. And then we go out to Ballarat in Victoria, and then we go to Cranbourne, and then we go to Pakenham, then we go to Hoppers Crossing, and then we come back to New South Wales down towards ACT, and then we go across to WA. So you can see there how the numbers stack up. Very significant numbers in those postcodes. A lot of those are high leveraged households on the urban fringe with a lot of new development. Now, if we look at rental stress, the postcode with the largest rental stress count is Victoria 3000 in Melbourne, 14,000. And then we go to Toowoomba, and then we go to Liverpool and Campbelltown in New South Wales. Then we go to Mount Druitt, and then we go to more New South Wales postcodes. And in fact, Bondi is on this list still. I've mentioned that quite often. Bondi is one of those a higher affluent group suburbs, but a lot of people paying very big mortgages, very big rentals just to live there and are having difficulty with their cash flow. Surfers Paradise is on the list and a few other places. So a lot in New South Wales, and I noticed that Surrey Hills and Darlinghurst is quite near the top of the list too. Then if we go to stressed investors, so this is looking at it from the investment perspective. So here we're looking at people who are trying to rent their property out, trying to sell their investment property, have got vacancies, are in negative cash flow in terms of net cash flow. And there you can see that New South Wales, top of the list, Wentworthville, Westmead, and a few other places. WA, of course, is on the list too. Surfers Paradise, Melbourne, St Kilda, in Victoria, South Yarra, Darlinghurst. So what's interesting, quite a few of these are not necessarily just on the suburban fringe, but some of these are closer into the city as well. And a lot of those are to do with high rise and to do with apartment rentals that are actually still struggling. And until the migration really changes, that's not going to change anytime soon, I think. And overall financial stress, which is the aggregate measure, so it's basically not just an add-through, it's actually a re-optimized series. But you can see there that the financial stress is highest in terms of count in a postcode in Queensland, 4350 Toowoomba. New South Wales is then the second, that's Campbelltown. Then we go to Liverpool. So those three are where a lot of the issues are. Then Victoria, Melbourne, 3000. And then we go to Lethbridge Park in New South Wales, Hobbs Crossing, Point Cook and Derrimut in Victoria, Cranbourne, and then we come back to Wentworthville. So you can begin to see the same patterns, I'm afraid. And I'll also highlight down the list here, we've got the Central Coast, North Gosford is there as well. Then we have more high-growth suburbs like Fountain Gate and Narrowarren. And so it goes on, and Ipswich down the bottom. So that gives you a bit of a flavour of what I'm seeing. Now, I can just briefly, before I take some questions from the audience, just go and show you a few charts here. So this is the mortgage stress for New South Wales, centred on Sydney. And you can see there this Western Sydney splodge of more orangey-red colours. That is where we see the highest level in New South Wales. And if you drill in to closer in, you can see that as you drill in, there are areas which are also showing some signs of difficulty. But relatively speaking, the really big totals are out in Western Sydney, Blacktown there, as well as Liverpool and Campbelltown. Now, if I then just do a quick search, we could perhaps go to Victoria, for example, and just have a quick look there. And again, all I want to highlight is that as you pull out and begin to see some of the suburbs that are in difficulty, it's the same story, that it's the high growth corridors where a lot of the issues are. So here over towards the western side of Melbourne, as well as down towards Dandenong. And as you pull out further, you can see more of that coming to the fore. And then if you pull out a further till, you can start to see some of the other areas further out as well. So there you go, that gives you a bit of a flavour. And what's interesting again is that you see to the north, to the east and to the west, you've got these pockets. And a lot of those pockets are actually relating very much to the high growth corridors. Okay, I'm just going to put one more in here. And then if you want to get to more map information, put in the chat and I'll look later. I'm just going to Perth. There you go. Okay, so we're now over in the west. And as always with Perth, it's a bit of a hodgepodge as well. But as you pull out, you can start to see that there are actually some suburbs, particularly to the north and also to the south, high growth corridors where you start to see signs of difficulty. And it's really not much change over the last few months, because whilst there have been some areas that have improved somewhat, there are still many people who are highly leveraged. And I'd remind you that in Perth, a lot of the households have been very much seeing no growth in value since 2010-11, which is a long, long time. So there you go. That's a little bit of a sort of a start for the conversation. I'm going to have a quick look at now at the questions and see what you guys have been asking, and I'll try and answer some questions. And then I've got a few more charts to share with you later on. A lot of questions in the chat. And as with all of this, plenty of things. There's one from Jason there. Jason, thank you very much for the super chat. Really appreciate it. And I find your contributions superb in terms of helping to keep the show on the road. So thank you very much for that. Now let's just go back to the... Yes, very interesting comment there from Suzanne saying no more pounding the paper for jobs, wages barely exceed the dole prices, dollar average higher. Yeah, the financial profile from many Australians is pretty sick, actually, and I see that in the surveys all the time. What's really interesting about what's happened with households is that the cost of living is rising very fast. We know that fuel prices are high. We know that some of the other costs of living, even basic foods, are high. The momentum in terms of hours worked hasn't really recovered for everybody. Some have, but not a lot. And of course, they've still got this mortgage thing going along. A lot of people are highly leveraged into mortgage and into debt. And things like childcare costs and things like school fees are also hitting people quite hard. And even things like the latest, I'm in Wollongong. My local rates went up quite a bit this year. All of these are hitting quite hard. So it's the combination of all those things. And that's why I said earlier on, I don't think the real inflation number is anything as low as the true experience of many people in my surveys. A lot of people are saying, no, we've got real issues with what's going on. Thank you very much for those wishes. Appreciate it. Thank you for that, Aaron. I don't know about that. But look, I do this stuff because I think it's really, really important. I've got so frustrated with the mainstream media and the lack of objectivity that we're seeing from so many there. And you know, as soon as you start looking at the data, you start realizing there's a really important story to tell. So there you go. Well, that's why I do what I do. And Michael, thank you for that thought. Yeah, I must tell you that, you know, this asbestos stuff is horrendous. So she has a thing called mesothelioma, which is a very severe disease, only a survivability over 5 years of 6.5%. And, you know, her state of health is pretty disastrous. So she can hardly breathe. She's on oxygen most of the time. We're trying to balance controlling the pain using very strong painkillers, but trying not to suppress her breathing too much because you still want her to breathe. It's a nightmare. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And unfortunately, around one third of properties in Australia are asbestos ridden, and not necessarily just old properties, even some newer properties, because we're still importing fiberboard with an element of asbestos in it from places like China. And the point is, anybody who's doing DIY, you need to be aware that even small exposures, not just over a very long period or not just in the industrial context, but small exposures, just a single exposure is sufficient ultimately to trigger an asbestos-related disease. And as I may remind you again, 4,000 people a year die from asbestos-related disease, 4,000. And of those, more than 800 are from mesothelioma. That's the one that's killing my wife, Jill. And the story here is that there's very little public awareness of this. So that's why we are doing what we're doing with the charity and with the videos and everything else and with the ABC. So sorry, I've gone off on a bit of a deep end there, but it's really, really important. Cookie Boy makes a very important point too. Mental health issues. Yeah, it's fascinating. In the Hilda survey, there was a lot of information about how people were actually finding it more difficult. And so, you know, mental health issues and those sorts of psychological issues were much higher than they had been previously. And that's before COVID, because then data is to 2019. So I think it's a big and important issue. Okay, what else have I got here? Okay. Seeing where there are any specific questions. Cookie Boy says, $3 trillion of private debt amongst 26 million people. Nothing to worry about. Well, actually, it's even worse than that because it's not 26 million people, right? If you look at the total population base, it's a very small proportion, that actually is, borrowing the bulk of it. So it's not equally distributed across everybody. That's the problem. And that's why my mortgage stress information is so significant, because what it shows you is that there is a proportion of the population that's highly leveraged. And I also, as I mentioned with my show yesterday with Edwin, a lot of people are assuming that when the bank says, sure, you can have this mortgage, no problem, they're assuming the bank has done their affordability assessment for them. They haven't. All they've done is a risk assessment. And so quite often what I'm seeing now in my one-to-one conversations is people are realizing that their cash flows are not anything like what they thought they were going to be. As a result of that, it's a big deal. Kimber, like the dogs? Oh, very good. Well, you might show them again. They're still sound asleep. There you go. They are our pride and joy at the moment. One of the reasons why Jill is still at home rather than in hospital is because we've basically brought all the equipment here so that she can still be with the dogs and the dogs can be with her, because the joy that she gets even now from having the dogs with her when she's not too bad is huge. So that's why the dogs are very important, and they're certainly cute, even if they can be a bit noisy sometimes. They are Kelpies and Kelpie Cross, and they do make a lot of noise. Okay. Interesting question from Slacker. Well, if you want to put me in touch with the Sustainable Australia Party, I'm happy to have them on. I don't necessarily, pick who comes on. If people would like to reach for me and if they've got something to say, I'm happy to consider it. Just get them to contact me. Okay, let's see what else we've got. From Martha Singleton, the RBA decided to keep the rates at 1.1% for the rest of the year. So how will this affect household stress and property prices? I'll show you my scenarios in a moment. I've done some scenarios on that. But basically, if you think that the Reserve Bank's scenarios are right, then essentially it's certainly conceivable that prices continue to rise in areas. But if you think rates are going to start to rise, and the question is how much will they rise, that could make a huge difference. So we'll come on to that in a little while. I just want to kick through some of the early questions first, and then see where we go from there. Okay, let's have a look. Deborah says, thanks to your shows, I've started looking at houses much more critically instead of just thinking, wow, that's only 850k. And now thinks, but is it a good house? Great. Then it's working, Deborah. That's exactly right. So we're not, you know, I've never said don't buy. I'm just saying make sure you go through the critical faculty processes when you decide to buy, right? There are still good value properties around if you know where to look and if you're prepared to, you know, make a few compromises and what have you. But just don't take what the agent says as gospel. As Edwin and I keep saying, do your own due diligence. It will pay dividends. I honestly, you know, believe that. My own experience over 40 years of buying property is that it does make a huge difference. So banks aren't doing a serviceability assessment, only a risk assessment. Yeah, basically, so banks are thinking about it. Am I going to, this is the bank talking, am I going to lose money on this loan, right? So if there's equity in the property, that means that prices can drop a lot and you can still rely on the equity, which means the banks won't lose. They'll also get some information about, you know, various cost categories, although actually it's quite Mickey Mouse often, and they'll do some basic sort of calculations on income. They've got then got these formulae about what a typical person would do in terms of what they might spend or what they might not spend. So it doesn't necessarily translate to an individual cash flow. That's the problem. So there are these various ratios that people use. The case, the ASIC case with Westpac, was ASIC saying, no, you need to be more specific. You need to actually look at the details of individual households and work out what their real affordability is. And basically the courts threw that out. They said, no, you can use ratios. That's not a problem. So the sorts of things that banks are doing are very high level. And so, you know, if it's 95% mortgage and if it's marginal, they might do a bit more. But a lot of people, you know, are in the situation where they've got this big mortgage because the bank said they're happy to lend them that amount. And they've made the assumption that if the bank has lent them that amount, the bank then thinks they can service it. And I see again and again the fact that so often people can't service it, not without severe pressures. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. So understand the banks are coming from a risk perspective, a risk of loss to them, not the issue of what it means for that household in terms of how they service the loan. Big deal, very important deal. Cookie Boy makes a point, banks are toughening up. Yep, I'm seeing it too. So on average now, the amount of borrowing power that you've got, if you're a typical borrower, is down between 5 and 10% from where it was 3 months ago, 5 and 10% lower. And in some cases, quite a lot lower. And they're also being much more picky now on interest-only loans and a few other things. So slowly but surely. But it's interesting, you know, the Reserve Bank is saying that the lenders should be careful about their responsible lending issues and their risk issues. But a lot of lenders are still being very generous, too generous in my view. And compared with just a few years ago, you know, the amount that people are borrowing, 8-9 times income still happening in Sydney from a lot of first-time buyers, I find that a scary number, particularly when incomes aren't growing. Because that's the other point, of course. Previously, in the early 2000s, people were able to get out of jail because effectively what happened was that incomes grew much faster than the mortgage repayments. And so they were able to get ahead, but now incomes are not. And even the Reserve Bank is saying they don't expect incomes to grow very, very much in the time ahead. Interest rates are going to rise, so the cost of mortgages are going to rise. So I think people need to be quite cautious at the moment. Okay. Hot Copper says, real estate, it is not it scam dream. Yeah, well, you know, there's a Ponzi scheme here, right? Basically, it's a story of you need to pull more people in, you need to bring more migrants in, and if you keep lending more, prices go higher. If you can make prices go higher, then you can actually pull more people in. The banks increase their capital base, they can lend more, they basically create money out of thin air. That's the Ponzi scheme, right? And of course, the wealth effect, quote unquote, it's just on paper, it's not real, is the other side of it. So politicians claim that that's good because it gives people a greater sense of confidence. Except if you've got really big mortgage, then it's much, much harder to spend. The thing I don't get, and this is what I find really astonishing, that economists haven't worked out that if you actually didn't have to pay so much for housing, you'd have more free cash available, and that free cash could then be actually presented, to do other things and buy other things and therefore create more economic momentum. So in fact, all of this debt for housing is sucking the air out of the rest of the economy. And banks, of course, don't want to lend to the rest of the business. They'd much prefer to lend just to those who are, borrowing and borrowing more. It's crazy times. So I find this troubling, to say the least. But there you go. It's been like it for 30 years. I don't think it's going to change particularly anytime soon, unfortunately. But that's what I'm thinking. All right, how are we doing? Interesting comment from Acrostic Chanch here. I spent $3,500 on an independent inspector of my new home build. Last week, a friend said she'd had nothing but trouble with her new build, even the front door put all upside down. Yeah. Unfortunately, new builds are not, necessarily going to be perfect. And in fact, it's really important to make sure you get the right certification, because if you don't, then it can be a real issue later. So, yep, that's a very important point. And Aaron makes the point, how can you have $1 million in debt and sleep? I don't know. I mean, I've been debt-free for a long, long time. My father was a bank manager. I did get a big mortgage early on in my life, but I paid it down as quickly as I could. And I've always believed that debt limits your choices. Now, there are many people out there who believe that you can be in perpetual debt and just, roll it over and keep borrowing more and more and more. That's what the financial system wants you to believe, because, of course, that's how they make their money. You are a cash flow. The more that you pay in debt, the more you pay in interest, the bigger their profits. But the question is that actually a sensible strategy, really? And that's the question. Now, some people seem quite comfortable with that, younger people in particular, and then they go for the buy now, pay later and the other facilities, which are quasi-debt as well. But at the end of the day, if things go wrong, if suddenly you can't work anymore or your income gets crimped, that's when things get difficult. So my own view is that debt is a necessary evil, but it's something that you've got to just be careful with. And I personally don't think that you should be wired to borrow permanently. But that's, of course, what the financial system wants you to do, and that's what the consumer society wants you to do too. Interesting one from NA here. If we got more money to spend, we pollute the world more, and it will upset the crazy environmental pollution freaks. Well, it depends on what you buy, right? You could buy environmentally, credible things. It absolutely depends on what you do with that disposable income. So I'm not sure I'd necessarily argue that it's negative to the environment. In fact, it might be positive to the environment, but that's another story. But I take the point. Unfortunately, at the moment, what tends to happen is that because people don't have a lot of money, they tend to buy up a lot of cheap stuff. Cheap stuff is throwaway stuff. And so you end up sort of throwing away much more quickly than previously. I actually buy secondhand studio gear, for example, on eBay and things like that, because I refuse to pay full prices, right? A lot of people just give away gear and much cheaper. So look, there's a whole story here about how you can actually maximize what you have. And there is also another point, and that is that the throwaway society and cheapness and not being able to afford good quality stuff is all linked, I think. This is an interesting question. Shut up and buy. Banks often split loans. A couple type of $1 million loan, but issue it at 2 by 500K, just reducing the LVR. Is there any data out there for average loan size once those splits are recombined? No, there is not. So APRA only reports individual loans. They admitted that in front of an inquiry in Parliament some time ago. So there is no information about the aggregated level of debt other than my surveys. And one of the reasons why my surveys come out with different stories is because I aggregate. So I look at the total debt pool rather than the individual loans. And you're right, people have 2-3 loans, split them up, lower loan-to-value ratios, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, quite often they might have a primary loan and then another loan tacked on as well. So it can get quite complicated. And that's why it's quite important that people understand precisely what's going on here. Jeff says, I'm seeing listing numbers rise even in the lead up to Christmas in the Melbourne. Are you seeing this trend elsewhere? Yes, we are. In fact, Edwin and I did a show the other day, and we specifically went through some of the data in terms of what's going on with regard to listings and with what's going on with regard to the rise there. And we made the argument that a lot of the listings that are coming on are for sales. Also, some of the prime property, the sort of the A-class property, is now being removed because it's not meeting the expectations in terms of price. So we're seeing a proliferation in numbers, but not necessarily quality. And that's another reason why some of the momentum that we saw previously has dropped away a bit. And Paul says, feel low, we'll keep rates low forever in spite of the rising inflation. Don't want to pop the bubble. Well, that's the point. Of course, he knows, Phil Lowe knows, that if he raises interest rates, that's a problem. And the Peter Tulip modelling, which was RBA modelling, said that if you put interest rates down 100 basis points, you get more than a 30% rise in property prices. The reverse is also true. If you lift interest rates by 100 basis points or 1%, you get a 30% fall in property prices in the subsequent 3 years. So that's the thing that Lowe is wrestling with now. He's boxed himself into a major corner, in my view. And I said earlier on, I'm not sure that the Reserve Bank really deserves to do anything, because it's really led us up this blind alley. And it's the same as the Fed. The Fed has got the same issue, right? Because they are caught between inflation on one side and needing to try and support the economy on the other side. And I'll show you some more slides on that towards the end of the show. Master Singleton says, for woodworking and metal tools, I always buy vintage. Yeah, it amazes me. I've still got some old tools in my toolbox from years and years ago, which are actually still serviceable and working really well, compared with a few tools that I've been given more recently that have already fallen apart. They're just, the quality isn't there. So I agree. You know, shiny new stuff isn't necessarily always good quality stuff. All right. So I think I've caught up to date on the comments. Just a comment from Tristan. Paul, the solve global warming, pull people out of poverty. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You see, if you look at it holistically, right, there's enough on the planet for everybody to have a reasonable amount. It's just that, unfortunately, a bit of the planet is eating two or three times the total value of the planet. That's the problem we've got. So we've got this inequality. And then we've got this concentration of wealth in a smaller proportion, even within, you know, more affluent Western countries. So there's a fundamental question here about rebalancing and how you rebalance. And, of course, the real story is that that does mean that at the top, people are going to have to accept less. I think that's probably right. But I agree also we have to pull people out of poverty at the bottom. Of course, as people come out of poverty, they want, you know, the same shiny things and internet and power. And that's why China's building power stations and coal burning power stations of that, because it's part of the developing of a more modern Western economy, as it were. But tricky. It is really tricky. Okay. Vincent asks, I asked you 2 years ago if we're going the way of Bank of Japan. Interested to see if your stance is now same. I still think we are. I don't see any way out of this. Phil Lowe's still buying bonds. How much more will he buy? Don't know. I think the only thing that I would say is that if the other central banks around the world do actually take an axe to low rates and lift them up, and they might well do that, that could mean that we end up with the higher rates. And if we get higher rates, then that might have an impact. But I also don't think they've got much headroom, as I'll show you as we get towards the end of the show with some of my other modelling. Okay, now let me go then back to, let's go back there. Let's go over there, go over there. See how the doggies are doing. Oh, there you go. Have they moved? No, not really. They're still very much where they were. It's quite funny, really. Spending all evening. I'm just going to switch on to the next slide and then I'll come across here. Okay, now let's just touch on my scenarios for a bit then. As I remind you, my scenarios are a way of exploring different futures. It's not trying to estimate precisely what's going to happen. I'm not making predictions. None of the scenarios may be right, but it does try to give you a bit of a sense of what may happen ahead. And so in that context, there was this slide from Westpac, which made the point that monetary policy expectations are now indicating rate rises. These are the different banks, the Fed, the little triangles, the Bank of China, the Bank of England, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, right up there at more than nearly 200 basis points or 2%, and the RBA. And this is the RBA trajectory. So this is what the monetary policy expectations from the market. This is basically what the market is thinking is going to happen. And according to those rates, the RBA is going to dramatically outpace the Fed in terms of tightening, despite the US having a 1% lower employment rate plus double the wages growth and CPI. And of course, those five RBA rate hikes over the next 18 months, they're not going to smash growth, are they? They're not going to sort of do anything to house prices, are they? Which is absolute rubbish. So this is the problem I've got. There's a massive disconnect here between what the markets is saying is going to happen and what the Reserve Bank is saying is going to happen, which makes it very difficult to try and actually work out scenarios. But anyway, RBA and markets are in a different place. Markets are saying by, you know, middle of Feb 23, we'll be 125 basis points higher than where we are today, which will put rates at around, I don't know, 2%, maybe 1.5%, give or take. So I'll make this point. Frydenberg actually said that he was pressing the RBA and APRA on housing. And I have to say that I found this a very weird article insofar that it's a very important issue. A lot of people, you know, are challenged with higher house prices. I met the financial council of financial regulator. I was supportive of what APRA did, increasing the serviceability buffer. I mean, he's trying to sort of play it two ways, right? Frydenberg is part of the problem, not part of the solution here. And, you know, I've shown you those house price movements. Interestingly, everybody is now forecasting a fall of some sort in 2023. ANZ fall of 4% in 2023, followed by a 6% rise, follow a 6% rise in 2022. CBA is modelling a 10% fall in 2023 with a cash rate of 1.25%. And Westpac is looking for a moderation and a 5% correction in 2023. So that's where the banks are at the moment. Now, of course, the banks are talking their own book somewhat, right? Now, here is my scenarios. And I just want to make this point. My baseline for the next sort of 2 years or so, 2 to 3 years, is basically about 1.5%. I think that's probably where the RBA will be, which is more aggressive than where the RBA says it's going to be, but it's not as aggressive what the markets are saying. And 4.75% unemployment rate is certainly conceivable. And if we get there, then we could see home prices probably moderate, not dramatically so. There might be some that rise slightly, but it's basically the end of the big boom in prices and probably a bit of a fall. I give that a 10% rating. My base case, this is what I think is most likely to happen at the moment, is that we probably will get small rate rises, only about 1%, and unemployment rate will be slightly higher, the mortgage stress will be higher, the losses will be higher, and home prices will be down a bit, so down 20% perhaps, or, you know, depends, units, houses will behave differently. I give that a major probability. And then if you go longer-term crunch, then you've got these other scenarios, which are more drops but less weighted. But the problem I've got is it's hard for me to see how you can actually run a scenario with stronger interest rates. So if you put the interest rate up to, say, 3% or 4%, the cash rate, you would immediately see mortgage stress go up towards 50%, and you would immediately see house prices fall by 30 to 40%. And I don't think that's a valid scenario at the moment. I can't see how that can conceivably happen. So the Reserve Bank, I think, is caught with these low rates. So that's why I have not done a scenario that actually is projected with higher interest rates than the 1.5%, which is what the Reserve Bank is saying. Now, you know, I could do that scenario, but I just don't think it's conceivable at the moment, unless we see all the other central banks around the world lifting their rates significantly. And then because of the exchange rate movement that would actually be created against Australia, the Reserve Bank would have to respond. Now, that is a scenario, but at the moment, it's not one that I actually think is very likely on my central scenario. So that's basically what I think is likely to happen. And so I sort of incorporate this information then in my modelling, which then allows me to talk about individual postcodes and locations, you know, if I want to do that. So I don't know whether that makes sense, but that's what I've modelled anyway in terms of that. Now, just in terms of other information I wanted to share, there were a few other things which I think are quite relevant. And I just want to go through them at the moment. So this was an interesting piece of information that came out today from the Australian PSI, which is basically the index, the services index. And what was fascinating about that was that the overall PSI was about 50, just under 50, so, you know, neutral. But within that, the business and property services sector is significantly down. So they said the index of business and property services rose by 7.4 points to 42 points in November, seasonally adjusted. That indicates a third month of contraction following 6 months of positive or stable conditions earlier in 21. And the number of response reported increased demand, but for the majority, supply disruption, border restrictions, and ongoing uncertainty had dampened the effect on demand in November. Businesses report being unable to visit their own and client sites and customers, deferring new orders and sales. So this is the property sector, right? So this is suggesting property is going to come off from a construction and from a management perspective. I think that's quite an important piece of data. We'll see where that works out. Also, this is the other interesting one. In the US, we're going to get the inflation rate on Friday, right? And the inflation rate could be quite strong. Some people are thinking it could actually be above 7% for November. And this is actually some recent surveys, and they've all been very significantly higher than previously. And if the inflation rate in the US is 7% or thereabouts, the Fed's going to have to do something quite quickly and lift rates. Now, what I just said earlier on, RBA going to be struggling to lift rates. We're going to be caught in a bit of a bind, I think. And interestingly, if you want inflation information, the Atlanta Fed has now come out with an inflation forecast. Well, it's an estimate. It's just a model of nearly more than 9% for this current cycle. 9% inflation. If that is anything like true, that will put the cat among the pigeons. That will really create huge momentum and questions in the market. Now, interestingly, of course, the other one, the New York Fed, has suspended its now casting of GDP, saying it's trying to figure out how to do it. So I think that's fascinating that since August they've stopped forecasting GDP in the US. Now, Morgan Stanley had an interesting chart and basically is arguing that the S&P 500 price incomes is actually normalizing, and it's actually been normalizing for a little while. So basically they're arguing that this is probably an indication of the end of the bull market and the fact that we're beginning now to start to see some price earnings normalization coming through. If that's true, then essentially the Fed will be able to tighten on autopilot. And so again, it's talking about tighter in the US. Tighter in the US means markets will come down, and once again, we could be in a situation where we actually end up with not much momentum. So I think it's a very important story there. And again, it's not been well covered. Also, the flat yield curve. Flat yield curve basically suggests we don't know what's going to happen next. I did a post on that over the weekend. The fact is that the comparison of the 10 to 2 year, this is the US bonds, shows that there is almost no difference now, which is weird because that's an uncertainty sign. So we're in uncertain times in the markets. And yet, we had a very strong ISM reading in the US, so there isn't necessarily stagnation in the US in terms of momentum. So we've got this expectation of high growth, inflation, services sector looks pretty strong, all telling me that the Fed's going to have to do something. And also, the US employment is improving. It's still lower from where it was previously, but it's improving, not too bad, not perhaps as much as people expected. And this is the other interesting chart. If you look at the US, US long bonds have still beaten non-US stocks, in other words, the rest of the world. So in fact, going back to my question, I did a show with Peter Schiff. You may have seen that show where we were discussing as to whether gold is the safe haven or whether bonds are a safe haven. And interestingly, the fact of the matter is that bonds have actually outperformed gold dramatically over the last 20 years. Now, Peter Schiff is saying, well, of course, gold will come to its own. But gold is under 1800 US at the moment. It's been there for a long time. And if it is deflationary that we're going to see, you know, it's not necessarily true that gold is going to necessarily be that fantastic. In an inflation world, it could be a potential store of value. But if it is deflationary, then it might be an issue. And talking about deflation, I still think deflation is the long-term game here. I think Japan is still where we're going to end up. And I think we're going to be going in that direction partly because of what's happened with what the Fed is now having to deal with. And that cartoon I showed you at the start, to me, just typifies wonderfully what is precisely going on. Now, Vincent makes an interesting point. We'll just put that up. Thanks, Vincent, for your comment there. RBA will have no problem keeping rates low and having the Aussie dollar weaker, which helps our exports. So the status quo and no change in interest rates. Mid-2023, my prediction. Yeah, well, you know, I said I can't see much, a bit maybe, but not much. And that takes us to the Japan problem. Of course, the other thing you've got to think about here is Chinese exports probably perhaps coming off, the China Evergrande thing bubbling away and maybe getting worse. You know, there are lots of other externalities which suggest that the economy may actually be hit as well. Interesting, and you know, Chopper says, I have a love-hate relationship with gold. Yeah, well, in the days when, you know, in the good old days, well, maybe the good old days, gold was actually the foundation of the monetary system, gold made sense. But the fact that we've now got the 50-to-1 relationship between gold futures and underlying gold means that you can't actually use gold the same way. And I did ask Peter Schiff that question. He didn't really answer the question. I didn't want to push him too hard, right? But I think it's a big question, right? But the fact is that if you've got all these futures contracts sitting over the underlying, then frankly, what the value of the underlying is largely irrelevant. And you know that a lot of people are taking positions and actually betting on movements in gold rather than actually taking the underlying position because you've got 50 times the futures contracts relative to the underlying. So that's why I think gold is much more suspect. And of course, a lot of people don't have gold. They have access to gold in theory. But of course, if you don't hold the gold, then do you hold the gold? And do you know, that may be an interesting debate to have later, particularly if people start wanting to get hold of the gold and then realize that that same gold is lent out to multiple people. And that's part of the gold problem. Jason said, yeah, the dogs looked too tired to wake up. Yeah, I've taken a few walks today, and it's very funny because they do sort of go to sleep at this time of night. There you go. Not moved. I promise you that's not a still. That is actually a live camera just showing the dogs where they are. So I'm afraid they may have shifted slightly, but not a lot. Yeah, glad to help. Okay, what else have I got? What else? Let's have a look here. Okay. I want to share this other slide. This is a fascinating slide too. So this is actually another one. This is actually from John Authors from Bloomberg, and he does a great job on picking this market apart. And the stock's great post-pandemic run compared to bonds has been interrupted. So this is very interesting because basically stocks were doing quite well compared to bonds until recently. And now all of a sudden, bonds seem to be outperforming stocks. And if you believe, as I do, that we could well be in the situation where effectively we see stocks coming off, you know, bonds are effectively possibly one area where there is still opportunity. And of course, Harry Dent argues that very few, that, you know, treasuries in the US are the sort of the most stable and most secure of all the returns. I've done pretty well according to those charts, but we'll see. I argue that there's no such thing as any safe haven. Wherever you look, you know, there's risk. And Jason says, relating to the dogs, you walk them well. Well, it is walk the world. What do you expect, you know? That's one of the reasons why it's called what it is. Yeah, they go for at least 3 walks a day. They're kelpies, right? So they need a lot of exercise. I need a lot of exercise too. It keeps me a little sane. Okay. Where am I? What else am I going to talk about? Okay. So in terms of other things we can talk about this evening, let me just put the questions up, see if there's anything I've missed. There's a few things I wanted just to touch on, but I'll just pick up this. Gold is controlled by derivatives, illegally by big investment banks. Yeah, that's the point. It's completely non-transparent. It's gold and silver, the same problem. You've got all of these multiple holders. You've got all of these people lending gold, moving it around. And interestingly, of course, China and Russia have been acquiring gold for quite some time. And one would argue possibly that they think that that's because it's more secure than US dollars. And it goes back actually to the question of whether you think the US dollar is ultimately going to maintain its status as that sort of cornerstone, or whether in fact ceases to become that cornerstone, and what replaces it. So who knows? Okay. And Bondi Steve says, go Harry Dent. Well, you know, Harry's consistent. You've got to say it, Harry is consistent. He might be right, he might be wrong, but he makes some really, really good points. And, you know, just to sort of reiterate that, his argument is like this. You can't go on pumping forever because you have to logarithmically pump more and more from central banks to get anywhere. So at some point, the central bank dance is going to end. As soon as the central bank dance is going to end, stock markets have got to start correcting, because stock markets are way overvalued. Peter Schiff agrees as well. When stock markets are so overvalued, they will come back. When they come back, this will not be just a minor correction. It will be a very significant correction. And therefore, the thing to do is to get out of the market and be prepared for that, so that when you can come in and buy cheap later. And what you buy, of course, is determined, I guess, what asset classes you want to get later. But he's basically saying, and he's been saying for some time, it could crumb. But then, of course, he's been caught out, because the the Fed keeps printing and everybody else keeps printing and the Eurozone keeps printing and Reserve Bank of Australia keeps, you know, buying more bonds. So it's postponed this sort of correction that he thinks is there. Now, there are other people who think none of that. Actually, in absolute terms, the markets are sustainable. But I cannot reconcile the current price-to-earnings ratios on most of the stocks that I look at with long-term value. There are a few that still look quite good, but a lot don't. And so I think things are overvalued. And if interest rates start to rise, that's going to have a very big, significant impact, particularly on things like the NASDAQ, right? And one of the reasons why the NASDAQ is down so much is because of the discount factor relating to the future value of large tech funds. You know, if you believe that tech funds are going to be generating huge amounts of value down the track, then what you would do is you would discount those future values based on the discount rate. Now, that discount rate will be determined by what you think future interest rates are going to be. That's the net present value of those future rates. And that's a very significant factor when you actually come to think about how this all works out. So if we do look at the NASDAQ, for example, let's just put that up for it. There's the NASDAQ. So if you look at it, you can see that the NASDAQ's come back. It's at 15.225 at the moment, right? We got to 16.2. That is to do with the discounting of future rates. Now, how do you work out what the discount rate is? Well, that's, of course, an interesting question. And probably it's worth looking at the 10-year bond and seeing what that is doing. And you can see there that the 10-year bond in the US is at 1.4. Now, it went up as high as 1.6, then came back, dropped as low as 1.3, and now it's at 1.4. So that is a determinant of what the future value of some of these stocks that may not be creating huge value today but will be creating huge value in the future, which is why people like Tesla and things are valued by that. And then the other thing that's just worth thinking about is the VIX, or the volatility index, right, which is effectively the so-called fear index, as it's called. And the VIX is very interesting, because basically the markets will tell you if it's above 30, that's a very, very skittish market and, you know, people are concerned. It's dropped back now. It's at 23, but it got well over 30, right, for a little while there over a few days ago. And that got people worried about the uncertainty in the market. So it's a reflection, if you like, of the potential for risk ahead. And just while I'm here, I'll just give you an update on Bitcoin. So we're sitting at 51,287 at the moment. Obviously, we had this bit of a flash crash to 46 over the weekend, down from the recent highs of 68, 69. So we're down considerably. And, the interesting question is why? And one of the things that I've discovered there as I've looked at some of the issues is, again, it's to do with futures and how futures works. And one of the interesting things is that futures, Bitcoin futures, is actually manipulated quite strongly by some of the big players. So, in fact, what I'm seeing is that Bitcoin is beginning to behave in a somewhat similar fashion to gold, with the futures market determining the price of the current market, which I think is quite interesting. And I have a feeling that some of the big players are actually now playing the same game as with gold. And just on gold, 1779 at the moment. So you can see we got just over the 1800, end of November, but we're back down there. And if you look long term, it's been pretty much in that area. So gold is not behaving anything like the way that people expect it was going to behave, which is fascinating in terms of the way things are going. And while I'm here, Evergrande, 183, tells you something, doesn't it? So Evergrande last week basically said they weren't sure they could pay their creditors, and that put further pressure on them too. So there you go. That's some interesting update in terms of the markets while I'm here. All right, what else have we got? Let's have a look. Paul said, people feel cornered and the fear sets in. This is when the real problems begin. Yeah, it is a confidence issue, isn't it? So a lot of these markets are driven ultimately by confidence and the fact that, the expectation is that things are going to be supported by central banks. If you really do go on believing that central banks will always bail you out, and a lot of market participants still believe that the Fed will not fail them, the Fed will go on bailing out, then, of course, the markets will continue in their really weird trajectory, where in fact, frankly, it's very tough to work out what's going on. But if you believe that the future is different and that effectively central banks will have to stop, and the tapering data that I showed you earlier on and the inflation data and everything else suggests to me that this is going to be an issue, then once that starts, confidence ebbs, and then people are going to start panicking. And it is conceivable that the markets are, well, maybe 30 to 40% over values. Harry thinks we could see values cut in half. He's sort of using an analogue of what happened in the Great Depression. Not sure whether that's legitimate or not, but it is interesting that the expectation there is that prices could fall significantly. And there are people, of course, sitting on the position to try and benefit from the falls, and people have been holding that position for some time, expecting it to happen and then not happening. So a bit of an interesting question about whether it will happen before the end of the year or not. Don't know. We'll see. Very important one from Avdad. Another big wealth transfer event is coming. You will own nothing and be happy. Try to be on the right side of it. Well, that's right. And it is interesting, of course, if you take the, that little mantra about you will own nothing and be happy, that is very much the story from some of those global entities in the Davos mob, the people who think they've got the right to determine the future of the whole planet, frankly. But it is making the point that maybe you won't own anything, maybe you'll just rent what you need, right? And that goes from a frying pan to a house to everything. Interesting philosophy there, and the interesting question, of course, is whether that makes sense or not. My own view is that there are risks attached to that, not least because once you basically have the everything, as a cash flow, and think of the software companies. I've had an interesting run-in with one of my providers. I use a particular set of software for my modelling, and they basically change the pricing model from a sort of one-time price, which I was happy to pay. And they said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. What we want you to pay every year, right? And so they're turning it into a cash flow. And suddenly you don't own it anymore. What you do is own a right to it. Now, that model is being used more and more and more for so many different things. And that's what ultimately the you won't own anything is about. And if you think about it, as a mortgage, if you've got a mortgage and your mortgage is, what, 30, 40 years, right, and you just go on paying, in a way, you never own the property. You are basically just an alternative renter. And the rent seekers, of course, are the banks and the other financial institutions, and they love it because they'll go on those cash flows forever. And so what we've done is we've created this series of cash flows for everything. And that's what is behind this thought. I think, you know, I've got a real issue with this, I must say. And I think that the Davos Club is really part of the problem, not part of the solution. In fact, Jason agrees, I think. Those poor people in the Davos Club, like they know anything. Well, you know, they know about wealth preservation for themselves, and they think they know what's good for us all. Now, they're non-elected, right? They've got no accountability, no democracy. No, I've got major issues with this. And of course, if you think of what the G20 has done and other things like that, a lot of it is being driven from that top down. Let's take bank deposit bail-in, right, which is still live, by the way, in Australia and in New Zealand and elsewhere. Bank deposit bail-in was an idea hatched post the global financial crisis to try and stop the banks being rescued by the public purse. Why not use depositor money? And it was cooked up by some bankers, right? And those bankers then basically put this concept into play. It ultimately got picked up by the World Economic Forum and, you know, the World Bank and everybody, and the G20 signed up to it. And then the G20 then had to go and implement it. And of course, there was a shuffling of feet in various parts of the world when the G20 members started implementing it. So in New Zealand, it's a very transparent open banking resolution. It's very clear. Deposits are to be grabbed if a bank is failing. And if that bank is failing, then essentially it can be rescued using those deposits. And you become a shareholder in the bank rather than a depositor. And you can do that because deposits are an unsecured contribution, unsecured loan to the bank. In Australia, of course, it's much, much more, well, vague. There's an APRA Act. APRA has the right to bail in any other instrument. Does that include deposits? Well, it's not clear. We tried to get some of the legislation changed to take that clarity. That was rejected because, of course, APRA didn't want to actually be bound by it. But it's a classic example of where a theory developed by a few to benefit a few gets implemented through the system, through the G20, no real consultation locally. And that's the problem. And I see this again and again and again with the Davos model and with some of these global entities. And then they, of course, come out with all these reports, like the World Economic Forum, the OECD, all of these people, you know, with these, must do this, must do that, right? again, no real accountability, just you know, opinion. And I often think that they are so indoctrinated with the neoliberal view and so indoctrinated with the bigger way of thinking that they necessarily contaminate some of the thinking that perhaps should be being done. So I'm very sceptical of some of these global entities, I'm afraid, and the Davos mob, to my mind, would do better just to disappear. Interesting question, comment here. I purchased the game and got banned from playing it and refused a refund. Now stuck with the license of the game I can't use or give to someone else. Yep, exactly. Yeah, it is. It is. It is very interesting. the whole point is that, you know, you end up damp end of the stick all the time. Now, actually, I should explain the ding-dong. My phone is on. The reason my phone is on is in case my wife has an emergency. So that's why the phone is on. I apologize for the ding-dong. So just to explain the ding-dong, it's important that if necessary, I can just drop everything and run the fixer problem if there's a problem. But there we go. And Mike asked about pharma companies. Yeah, I have the same issue with some of the things that they've been up to as well. I'm afraid their motives are not as clear-cut as perhaps some would like them to be. And, you know, it's very hard to really pull this apart. And, in fact, I did a show the other day, it's back on the asbestos front, talking about capture, industry capture, and how it is that large corporations can actually influence governments, public policy, and everything else. And if you've not seen that show, it's worth watching, not just for the asbestos story, which is a disgrace, but also for the way that the capture works And I see this idea of industry capture where effectively governments and other regulators are caught by these large, powerful organisations with a big ability to influence and with a big ability to be able to actually just grab something and steer it in their direction for their own interests and returns. And you know, the problem I've got is these corporations, particularly multinational corporations, are non-elected and basically have more power than individual countries and bigger budgets than individual countries. And the fact of the matter is that you know, some of the things they do, it's not actually good for ordinary people. And that's what I come back to. So, you know, my philosophical position here, just to be clear, is that society should be for the benefit of ordinary people, right? Businesses and ordinary people. It shouldn't just be for the benefit of the few. And unfortunately, we've got to the situation now where everything is judged through a particular lens, which is effectively to the benefit of the few, to the benefit of the powerful. And the rest of society is seen as, you know, the sheeple that just trot on behind and, you know, we'll keep you distracted with the Netflix and things like that. And, you know, we'll just make sure that you go on paying through, you know, your mortgages and through other subscription services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And we've somehow lost the plot. And it seems to me that the real question here is, what is society for? And I don't think society is just for the maximisation of rich for the rich. Well, for the rich, but that's where we've got to. And that has created huge distortions with our own economy and with our own country, but also huge distortions across countries too. And so if you come to things like, you know, the question of dealing with, you know, the decarbonizing and those sorts of things, it's got all cross-wired with all of this other stuff going on. And that's why we've got the mess we've got. And of course, the question is, was it actually always planned to be? And, you know, as Ross said, but that was the plan. Well, maybe. Now, you know, there are people who believe that there are dark forces pulling the levers behind the scenes. As I've said before, perhaps, you know, you either have the cock-up theory of history or you have the conspiracy theory of history. I tend to veer towards the cock-up theory of history simply because I'm not sure that people are actually really smart enough to do what some people are suggesting. But we'll see. But I do want people to understand that there is a set of things going on, right? And it's important to understand what those things are, you know, whether it's property or whether it's actually finance or whether it's the markets or whatever, because there are things going on that aren't necessarily obvious. And so if you're not careful, you get swept along and just assume that things happen in a particular way. The fact of the matter is that, you know, at the end of the day, it's not necessarily in our interest for these things to go on. It is pretty interesting, pretty interesting. There's a few alternative. Nationalised mines and minerals to create a strong Australia in the 21st century. Well, you know, I've got this theory that we should be building things. We should be manufacturing things, right? You know, batteries and what have you, rather than just shipping off the raw materials overseas and then pulling them back and paying a huge price for them. But there we go. It's interesting. And another one here, banks are just seen as your own money. Well, that's right. Actually, they create money from air, right? So they can create more money. So loans come first. They can create the loan out of thin air. It's just a book entry, right? And then the money is in the system. That's how they actually do it. So, but the point is, of course, that that actually has consequences. And whether it's private sector money creation or whether it's public sector money creation, the net effect is that it actually creates very, very weird things. Cookie Boy asks, would I do a live show on commercial property? If you can find me a commercial property person who is prepared to speak honestly about commercial property, I will do it. I've been trying really hard for the last 3 to 4 months to try and find somebody. Every time I find somebody, they're spruikers. They've got this sort of very strong view. Of course, property, commercial property is brilliant, you know. I want somebody who is honest about it. So if you can suggest anybody who's honest, I'm happy to have a show about it and I'm happy to do a live show about it. Okay. Suzanne says Russell Brand has some interesting theories on things. Yeah, interesting. Some a little bit wacky, but there you go. Well, you know, I've got this view. I'm a philosopher by training. And one of the things about being a philosopher is you try to ask the why question. Why are things the way they are, right? And that's what I try to do on these shows and elsewhere. And when you start asking the why question, you then actually begin to realize that there are things that can be done to change. But the first thing is to start asking the why questions. And if my shows help people to ask the why question, why are things where they are, you know, what is really going on, in my mind, that's a pretty good outcome. And that's one of the things that we try to do on the show here. And I get different people with different perspectives to come along and add other perspectives, but that's what we're about. And Cross Stitch Ange asked, any announcements about governments about home buying affordability? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that there will be stuff. Now, whether they'll make it as part of the platform for the next election or whether they'll do something before, remember that there's an affordability inquiry going on at the moment, which of course is MARP. It'll be looking just at supply side things rather than actually things they should be. I made a submission quite recently to that. And I think that they will try to do that. They will want to keep prices high up to the election. I wouldn't be surprised if Labour gets in and then everything goes pear-shaped, because effectively, suddenly, you know, the markets will turn. But they'll try and keep things going until the election, in my view, and that could well include some further announcements. Thank you very much. Well, I just call it as it is. You know, I've learnt now at my age, and because I don't work for anybody, I work for myself, I can pretty much say what I want to say. But I do base it not just on opinion. I do try and base it on data. I do try and base it also on what I'm seeing going on and, you know, trying to call out things, hopefully that help people to get a better perspective. And if I've done that, then I hopefully have achieved a little bit. All right, well, we're close to the end of the show now, and I didn't do any postcodes tonight, partly because some of one of the things I wanted to cover, and partly because I ran out of time again. So just in terms of, as I finish off the show, let me just say that if you want more information about what we do, go to walktheworld.com.au, including Walk the World Funds. Of course, Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth manages those funds. They've done quite well, and I do believe market exposure remains important, even though things could be a bit wobbly. And, of course, they have taken some very important positions ahead of the possible correction. The blog, the FA blog, contains a whole bunch more information about what I do, digitalfinanceanalytics.com/blog. You can go there and subscribe. And we also do Patreon as well, and there's a different tiers, but the one that's most relevant potentially is the mortgage stress tier at $50 a month plus GST, and that gives you access to all the information about all of the postcodes and all of the stress information and all of my modelling about where I think prices may go. I haven't gone through that tonight, but that is available, and you can get that for a month, or you can get it for multiple months by signing up on the Patreon there. I also can receive payment via PayPal, and people do that from time to time. Appreciate that as well. And also Bitcoin, if you want to use a QR code, there's one there, just to show that I am sort of digitally aware. And there's some merch as well, which just goes on ticking away. Next week, you know, a few weeks ago, I had Steve Keen and Victor Klein on, right? And we got through a lot of questions, but there were loads more questions. And I said to them, would you like to come back and do the other half of the argument? So we had the politics of economics last time. This time I want to have the economics of politics. And they've agreed to come back on next week. So they're on the 16th. And smooth operator, we'll get your question tabled, I promise, because there's a question there that was tabled and didn't manage to get put to them. It is something which I recommend coming along next week. Again, we're trying to get this political economic debate going. Steve, of course, is very, very powerful when it comes to some of his arguments. And Victor is politically aware, as you know, and leading the charge on a new political party. So that is next week. And I hope that you might think about coming along and being part of that show as well. There'll be more shows during the week. I always forget to put the please like this post on, but please like this post to make a difference in terms of actually helping to propagate what we do here. Subscription rate for the shows is quite variable, but some of them are doing quite well, others less so, but the like does help. So I'll be grateful if you do that. And if you've got other specific questions that you would like me to discuss on a future show, you can always send me a message via the DFA blog. There's a little message app there that you can use and send questions. That's one way of getting questions into me And Jason, thanks again for the super chat there. Why hasn't everyone hit the like button when it costs nothing? Thanks again, Martin. Appreciate your insights. Cheers all. Best wishes to all. Best wishes to wife, Martin. Hope things improve. Thanks, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate the wishes for my wife as well. Unfortunately, it's a one-way street that she's on, but we can try and make the journey as comfortable as we can to her ultimate destination, and it may not be that long. Okay, so that's it, I think. Reese says, control the media and control the world. Yes, I'm going to do a show about making the news and how it is that the media actually controls what we actually hear. Because there's a whole story to be told there, and I don't think it's been told. So that's another of my shows coming at some point. Watch out for that one. And Logan, thanks for that comment there. Cross-stitch, thanks very much. And being a carer is hard. It is. It's a full-time job. I'm very fortunate because Jill's twin sister from New Zealand, who's a qualified end-of-care life nurse, has come across and is with us. So she's actually helping to do some of the medical management of Jill at the moment. I couldn't carry on without her. And just to explain, I do the DFA thing because it's a really important distraction. So one of the reasons why I still do DFA, apart from the fact I love doing it, is that it's important for me not just to be completely defined by Jill's illness, but it is, you know, a huge proportion of my day at the moment. And I appreciate every other comment there. Thanks, Bondi Steve. Carly, thanks for that. fondle the button, people. Yes, please do. Yes, please like. Please like. Avdan says Omicron is Delta is an anagram for media control. That's quite a thought, isn't it? Well, I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with me. It's gone very, very quickly tonight. I haven't covered everything I expected to, but there you go. Hopefully you got something out of it. Look forward to seeing you next time. And thank you very much for all the support from the community, particularly now. It is greatly appreciated. Thanks for spending time with me, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.